All right. I don't know if Jason's on there or whatever, but Jay, you there?
Yeah, I'm here, man. I just was listening to the intro and letting it roll out. Cool. I'm digging it. Didn't know when to chime in and go, it's Sunday night and it's the U's, man, but that's awesome.
Yeah, it's a work in progress, man. We're currently kind of waiting for our guest to arrive, and in the meantime, I just want to kind of point out that, you know, Zach's in the chat room talking a bunch of shit. I'm just wondering if he's ever going to come up with a new set of jokes.
Well, he's really focused. You know, he lives through people's lives vicariously. It seems like, you know, he's got this fascination with you and your interest in anal sex, this fascination with me and the bondage thing. And it sounds like he's just desperate to stop having, you know, sex with his hand, I guess, and just have sex with, you know, I'd get a blow up doll or something, you know, he'd be all right going that way, I guess, too.
Nah, man, you can't knock Zach. He's the only dude I know that can harpoon Native Americans. I mean, he's like a land shark or a land pirate.
Aging it right now. Fuck ourselves. That's nice. So, I guess let's talk about, we're waiting on this dude to call in. E.A. Colletting is supposed to be our guest this evening. He's the author of several books, including a new title he's pushing. And, I took a bunch of notes and some stuff about what I want to talk to him about tonight. And the title of this one escapes me. I'm trying to remember here. It's the third of a series of left-hand path books. The dude is heavy into magic. He's been doing this pretty much, you know, the majority of his life. The interviews I've read, he's actually talked about how he's even done this stuff as a kid, practicing magic, interested in ritual, and almost on it.
For everybody who's listening, while Jason's kind of looking through his notes or whatever. If you notice, Mr. Coetting's name is actually linked to all of his books that are currently on Amazon. If you want to take a look and see what books Jason's talking about as he's talking about them, or when we finally do get Mr. Coetting on here, he makes reference to something he's written. You'll be able to see what it is. And it looks like our guest has finally arrived, so I'm gonna go ahead and bring him on.
Right on.
Hello, yeah, I apologize. I had some technical difficulties getting in for a minute there.
Oh, that's all good, man. Blog Talk Radio is packed full of technical difficulties.
Yeah, that's. I think that's gonna hit a wall with that. So yeah.
Right on. Well, you are E.A. Coetting. I'm saying that right?
Yeah, that is correct.
All right. My co-host on the air is Jason Sorrell. Jason, E.A.
What's going on, Mr. Coetting?
Great to meet you, Jason.
So, Jay, I'll let you start. You got a big, long list of notes, so.
Well, I guess why don't we start out with, I know that, just kind of give a little introduction to yourself. What are you about? We have a lot of listeners in the guest, the chat room right now, so I'm sure that those who aren't familiar with you would like to hear some sort of introduction. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I've really been actively involved in what I call practical spirituality for most of my life. Where, I really feel like you've got to be able to take whatever your spiritual paradigm is and use it to actually create something in your world, actually, get into the practical and the applicable aspects of whatever your spirituality is. And so obviously that led me directly into the occult pretty early. And so that's kind of been my journey is through the occult, but also through all other forms of mysticism, spirituality, et cetera, to kind of get to that point.
cool. And I've been reading some of the interviews that you've done, and just looking at different questions you've been asked, and so I'm kind of build on some of that. But your most recent book is, and if I mess this up, I apologize, but Evoking Eternity, is that your most recent book?
Tomorrow I've got Ipsissimus that's going to be coming out. So, you know, in just a few hours here, that'll be my most recent. That's Ipsissimus, and it deals with soul travel and kind of the whole process of spiritual ascent, more in a mystical way versus the magical way. So kind of the experience of your own basically eternal nature and how you can kind of bring that experience back to Earth.
Right on. And I've been, you know, again, I've been doing a little bit of studying on you, in preparation for the show. You're kind of a really fascinating dude. I mean, you've been all over the place. You came up from kind of I would almost call it a strict Christian background. I might be wrong about that, but you know, you didn't have a lot of toys. But you were always into, to one extent or another, magic. And now, not only are you doing, you know, you're not only an author, but you work on muscle cars and things like that as well, and kind of travel the world, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's I guess when people, you know, meet me, they're kind of thrown off because, you know, I'm not an ultra gloomy dude. You know, I'm not painting my fingernails black and whatever. I love working on muscle cars. I love working on motorcycles, just pumping them up, and you know, just I have regular hobbies. I've got a regular life. I've got, you know, a 6-year-old daughter. I'm a single father, and so I've got this, you know, a normal life, but these extraordinary experiences that kind of integrate into how I approach my life. So it's a really interesting kind of dichotomy there. I do kind of spread myself as far as my interest and my attention quite a range, you know.
Right on. And yeah, I got that from some of the videos I've seen, everything. I mean, looking at your picture and seeing the videos, you appear to be a very down-to-earth person. I mean, looking at you, unless maybe they understood some of the symbolism of some of the tattoos you have, if they were to see that, looking at you, you look like just a very regular guy, not what you would expect from somebody who's having these very mystical experiences, who's very, very knowledgeable in the occult. And you're, like you said, you're trying to take this and apply it practically. Like TC said, I got a list of questions. You talked about how when you were younger, because you kind of came up in a household that there wasn't, from what I've read, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for you to study the occult, you know, in a Christian household. But you felt like you experienced in your childhood that you were guided by figures who only you could see, and this kind of led you into your practicing magic as a teenager, and then of course leading up to adulthood. And you talk about in some of your books evoking spirits into a mm-hmm. material form, or having some sort of material, material manifestation.
Yeah.
I guess as far as that is concerned, these spiritual manifestations, these beings, what are they? I mean, how would you describe them? What are they about?
Well, you know, this is kind of a big question because it's one of the huge debates raging right now in the whole occult scene is what are these spirits, what are these powers, and whatever. And over the last 100 years, it's gotten really popular to dismiss it all as some kind of psychological mechanism, some kind of psychological tool, rather than something real. You know, you look back beyond the last 100 years, and you see that there was always this extreme traditional approach. If there's a spirit standing in front of you, you know, Occam would conclude that's what's there. That's what's going on. So they would take it more at face value, and now we've done less and less of that, started really picking at it and analyzing it. But I kind of lean more towards the fact that you are making contact with a consciousness that is completely external to you. Its manifestation, as far as how it appears, the fact that it speaks English, that it has limbs and features very similar to humans, kind of shows that the manifestation is a reflection of perhaps our expectations or even deeper Jungian archetypes, but that the consciousness behind it is very much objectively real.
So as far as these beings are concerned, I mean, like, in one of your interviews I read, you talked about how when you were then, this is kind of where it all coalesced for you, when you were 18 or 19 years old, you had evoked the demonic being Paimon. Am I pronouncing that right?
Paimon, yes.
Paimon. And this was, you know, this is one of these manifestations. You know, you had there was a physical experience, a physical presence of this being. He appeared in a mirror, and you were able to hear his voice. And this kind of brought it all together for you. What would beings like that want from us? What is their purpose in interacting with us?
I'm not sure that they're necessarily very concerned about interacting with us. We're extremely concerned about interacting with them, and so we're kind of the initiators of those contacts. I mean, there are, when it comes to most of the beings that you can find in a grimoire and then evoked, they're basically not prodding into this world, trying to penetrate the veil this way. It kind of relies on the operator to make that contact. So that's but then there are a whole host of other really supernatural and even diabolical phenomenon that happens around you, where there are these entities that seem to be really piercing through the veil this way and kind of prodding and very curious about us. But those aren't necessarily the beings that you would evoke. Those would be more kind of the spontaneous phantoms or spirits that we might come in contact with.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking is, and you'll have to forgive me, I don't have a lot of knowledge in this aspect of the whole the magical arena, but I mean, if you're you said you're an operator contacting one of these beings, unless they have some sort of interest in exchange or interaction with the operator, you know, you could in theory think that they could just ignore the person that was contacted. They could choose not to engage. But then we hear these stories, you know, throughout history of people who, you know, contact these other beings or are contacted by other beings. And, you know, and I look at the whole realm of manifestation could be, you know, very traditional, very historic as you've seen some of these beings, or could also be these people that are seeing, you know, UFOs and aliens might be experiencing a similar manifestation, but just in a different, it just, you know, expresses itself differently. But I'm wondering, you know, in your experience, you know, what do they get from interacting with you, I guess? You know, why do they go ahead and, you know, answer your questions or discuss things with you if they could, you know, just choose to ignore you and usually would not bother with you unless they're contacted by you?
Well, there are kind of two answers to that. And the first would be that the entities, these consciousnesses that you're calling on in evocation are really pretty set as far as you know, if you look through a grimoire, you'll see that every spirit has like its specialty. It's, you know, what it focuses on, what it can do for you if you call it. And you can basically see these consciousnesses, these spirits that you call up as manifestations of that one purpose, just like you can look through any pantheon and see that these are manifestations of various elements and emotions and such. Spirits would kind of fit into that as well, where they are manifestations or embodiments of that one specific power or attribute. And so when you're calling them, you're really engaging them in what they are already engaged in. You're funneling that power towards your goal. I mean, does that make sense at all?
Right. So what you're saying, I guess, is that normally there's no conscious direction to whatever it is they're doing. They're just this natural phenomenon. And then when you engage them, you're giving them some sort of conscious or intentional or causal purpose to whatever it is they're doing. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're basically funneling their attention towards your goal. And so it's not something that you have to plead with the spirit to do something. I mean, I think it's in Evoking Eternity. I make the comment that, if you go over to your friend's house and he serves you a nice meal, you don't ask him, well, what are you going to give me if I eat this meal that you just served me? So it's right. A very similar thing where this is what these spirits do. This is what these consciousnesses and powers are about. So you just kind of funnel it towards one specific goal, and it's really a natural flow. There's no need, if you look at the medieval form of evocation, there's no need to get a blasting rod out and command these things in the name of Jesus, or they'll somehow be spiritually penalized. That's kind of silly, because if you're working with the right spirit for the right goal, it should really be a natural flow.
And it seems that, again, reading some of the recent interviews, you have what I would say a natural talent for doing these kinds of things. And when I think about these kinds of talents, I assume it's a talent just like any other talent. There are some people who are born, let's say, who have a natural talent or natural affinity for creating artwork, let's say. So you seem to have an affinity for this kind of thing. But do you think that this can be a skill, different from a talent, that can be learned pretty much by anybody?
Just about anybody can pick this up and have some success with it, some amazing success with the occult. One of the amazing things about it that really drew me towards the occult is that it's verifiable, and it's a system. So you have this order of operations, and all you have to do is kind of plug yourself into that system, and it works. And not only does it work as far as producing whatever materialization you're looking for, but it also works as far as achieving your end result. And this is one of my big arguments for the fact that this isn't just all in my head, is the fact that I've got journals upon journals filled with rituals, as far as, I perform this ritual, and then shortly after, here's the result, time and again.
So, and I guess, let's slightly think my next set of questions. You talk about practical application, and I definitely see that being a major point, especially in the left-hand path, that if you're going to engage in a ritual or some sort of operating process, you want there to be, at the end of the process, a goal manifesting, that you want to achieve something or accomplish something. What are some practical applications of magic? Like, what are you doing, or what do you think is worth the effort?
It's always going to start out with really simple kind of petty things to kind of play with the power and see if you can get it to work. And those things will be, money and attention from certain people or certain forms of acknowledgement, sexual desires being fulfilled, emotional desires being fulfilled. That gets... I wouldn't say it gets boring really quick, but you kind of start seeing beyond that pretty quickly. Start kind of seeing a bigger picture where it's like, okay, wow, I've been able to make these things happen. Now what else can I do? And so, I've been at this since I was 12 is when I really started getting actively engaged in this, and I'm 30 now. So for quite some years I've been really actively fiercely engaged in my own spiritual potential, really, and what I'm working on at this moment is really a transfiguration of my entire life and the world around me that I interact with. So it goes beyond just having this lust and this desire fulfilled into how do I create Eden in my life.
If I could just kind of step in here, right, real quick, I'm just curious, is there any example off the top of your head of something that you've had success with that you maybe have written about in the past or whatever that you'd care to share with our audience?
One of them that comes to mind that I put in one of my books is that I had a friend, a roommate, about 8 to 10 years ago that I was staying with up in Wisconsin that had some, just where he came across a ton of money troubles, instantly just had basically just a ton of bricks fall on his head. And so he came to me and he just begging, you know, is there anything that we can do, please? And so I whip open a grimoire, the Book of the Sacred Magic of Abramelin the Mage, and go to a square there, draw the square with all the letters and symbols in it, do the ritual process of opening it, and then within 24 hours, he had all the money he needed to the dime, and it was in the amount of, you know, $4,000 or $5,000, and delivered just really literally at the doorstep. So, you know, these things, those are pretty, I mean, pretty commonplace now this last 10 years, where I know that, you know, if there's ever a time I really need or want anything, I manifest it, and not just in you know, desires of money and such like that, but relationships, daily interactions, the kind of flowing of abundance into my life. So yeah, I mean, it's just lists and lists. That's kind of one of the things where it, I really started seeing the potential of it. Wow, I can manifest $5,000 in 24 hours, you know, out of pure coincidence. And then the repeatability of it is really interesting.
Now, I'm curious because, I mean, the way it sounds to me at the moment is you drew this little magic square, you put all the correct symbols and stuff in it, and you did whatever evocation, and then boom, poof, the money appeared in a basket with a red ribbon on it and on the front doorstep the next day. Was there an actual... I'm sorry. Could I just finish the question?
Yeah.
What I'm curious about, was there a working process that went along with it, a physical hands-on kind of go out and get the money, or was it, in fact, just manifested?
It was manifested, and it's always brought by strange coincidence. In this case, without this friend of mine having to tell anybody besides me that things were awry financially in his life, he had a family member come by and just say, hey, you know, I felt like I needed to help you out. I'm not sure what with, but here's a few $1,000. Boom. So, you know, it'll happen a lot that way for myself, if I'm ever doing something to manifest money in my life, you know, I'll have the phone ring and have somebody, oh, hey, yeah, by the way, you know, there's this money that you loaned me or that I owe you for this or that, the other. And by really strange coincidences, it happens immediately after you perform the ritual. So it's really a fine line between coincidence and what I call, you know, coincidence, that what you're doing is coinciding with the performance of the ritual.
If it really works just like that, then you're my new best friend, man. We definitely need to hang out.
Yeah, well, and you do have people. I've got one of my biggest mentors, my greatest mentors is Dr. Thessalonia de Prince. He taught me Haitian Vodun and initiated me into the Vodun system, and he definitely uses this for prosperity like you wouldn't believe. I mean, the guy is incredibly wealthy. I'm not extremely motivated by that, so I've got my, you know, other successes that I do. You know, I can't remember the last time I actually hurt for money, but me, it's not a huge motivator for me. So everybody can kind of do with this what they want to and really achieve whatever their vision of their own personal paradise would be.
Right on. Well, one more from me, and then I'll let Jason go back to his list. But what I'm now kind of curious about here is, and forgive me as I try to reassemble a thought in my mind, what I'm curious about, because it seems to me that what you are talking about is something kind of akin to what we all would refer to as being psychodrama, but maybe a little more extrasensory than that?
How do you mean by psychodrama?
Well, I mean, obviously, you put yourself into this right frame of mind. You've tapped into these external influences, or at least the influences that you think are necessary to actually achieving the goal that you want. And from there, you know, the success of it just kind of follows. So that's what I mean.
Yeah, that's very much, I mean, how it works, where you can even pinpoint the exact brainwave states that you need to enter into, the physiological changes that you'll experience through the whole process. It's very much a triggering of the self. There is a definite link up with a field of energy and consciousness outside of yourself as well, of course, but that link up can't really be made until the internal physiological and psychological adjustments are kind of receptive to that.
All right. I thought that was important to put that in because I kind of wanted to take the hokey pokiness of it out of it so that our listeners can understand that what you're talking about is something that is, in fact, tangible.
Yeah, extraordinarily tangible. Yeah, and it's not, Sorcerer's Apprentice or whatever, you know, where you're, it's not like that at all. It is really a science of triggering these internal states that then have an immediate and direct effect on your environment. Yeah.
Okay, and now back to Jason.
Okay. And you kind of answered some of my questions already, and I wanted to move away from the pursuit of, we say petty, but, you know, tell a guy who's starving that $10 in his pocket is petty and he'll hit you. But the desire for, you know, like when you hear stories like this where somebody casts a spell, did a ritual, and my opinion is it doesn't matter what it is you're doing, it's pretty much all the same thing, praying, the whole bit. You do that, and you, like TC said, you kind of get yourself in that framework where now you're open to it. You know, you're open to the universe or whatever, the influences, the causalities, the coincidences, what have you, and lo and behold, it happens, and you make that connection. You say tomato, I say tomato. It could be, you know, it could be, like you said, coincidence, or it could be, you know, due to this ritual process. But you point out, though, that when you hear these stories, you hear about how somebody got just enough money, just enough of whatever, just the way it was going. And when you read other authors, they talk about how when you perform these rituals or these spells, that you're not going to necessarily get what you're asking for. You're going to get what you need. Now, you've got a friend, though, a mentor, that is very affluent because of his ritual practice. So you point out then that if a person were driven to pursue wealth through ritual, it can manifest that way. Is that correct?
Yeah. You know, and you can really look at it through, you know, Maslow's eyes as far as, you know, what somebody, like you said, who hasn't eaten in days sees as being a need is completely different than somebody like the prince who has several homes and travels the world and whatever. His idea of a dire need is much different. So, and it is just kind of ascending that pyramid and how a person decides to self-actualize. You don't necessarily need to scrape by with the minimum as far as what you're able to manifest spiritually in your life. You can really apply that however you want. It does kind of need to be in line with that self-actualization process, though, to some degree, where you really are in the right frame of mind and being state that you can receive that kind of abundance and still feel good about it, you know, because that really is a big part of it. If you're approaching a ritual to get money and you have feelings of guilt or whatever that are impeding that, it will definitely impede it. So it does need to be in line with kind of your personal value system.
But then also sounds like desire is a huge component in having something manifest. That, as Crowley, you know, points out, that you have to want it bad enough, I guess, for it to actually occur. Is that what you found? Because
I mean, that's, I guess that's my thinking, is that if it were just a process, if it were just, you know, flip this switch, turn this dial, and snap your fingers, and the process works, which is what you expect in science, there actually has to be a desire for the process to work in order for it to actually manifest. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, and it really works kind of in two ways. The first kind of state is that you have to have that intense desire, you know, intense enough for you to enter into a ritual and go through the process and then push the desire out. And good deal of these rituals are really based on venting the emotions and the desires intensely in a very specialized amount of time and with these symbolic influences that you've put around yourself, you know, in the temple that you've erected, that's going to channel the exact energy that you're wanting towards that exact goal. So you have to have that desire to be able to really push that out. And then after the ritual's over, there's really you have to reach this point of non-attachment to the goal as well, where you've exhausted all of your desire completely. So once the ritual's complete and finished, you blow the candles out or whatever, you're not really haunted by that, you know, am I going to be able to pay the bills or whatever it is that you're trying to manifest. It's completely clear. You know, you mentioned Crowley, and Crowley was completely broke, performed a ritual for money, and then took his last dollar and went and bought ice cream. That's how sure he was that it was going to work, and that's kind of a component of it as well. So you do need the desire. There are these extreme emotional components in the whole ritual as far as getting them out and then retracting from them.
Okay. So where in the chain of events, I'm just trying to imagine somebody, you know, myself having practiced ritual magic, for you, where in the chain of events does the ritual occur? Like, and from what I understand, talking to other people and everything else, usually if they need something, they exhaust every non-magical or every mundane method available to them to try to make that thing manifest, and then they go and do the ritual. And then when they do the ritual, of course, it's a question of whether or not, well, I needed a job, so I went out and I put out applications, I put out resumes, and I've been going months trying to find a job, and then I finally broke down and said, you know what, I'm going to do a ritual and see if that helps, and lo and behold, the place you put an application in a month ago finally called.
Yeah.
So where for you, do you put the ritual at the beginning and then go, or how do you process that?
You know, I really don't. I think that would be an extremely insecure way to live life, to feel like you have to have that backing in order to do anything, because I do think that if you're going to be a person of power, that really is reflected through a lot of your different activities in your life and different behaviors and characteristics in yourself. So yeah, I don't necessarily think that anybody ought to practice a ritual for anything that they're going to be doing in life, but not necessarily as a last resort either. I do think that spirituality and practical spirituality does need to be integrated into your life as far as who you are, but at the same time not completely dominated either, because there's a definite balance in everything. That you can definitely go overboard, especially in the occult. You do see a lot of people in the occult who really do go overboard. They don't have that balance and that anchor into you know, the real world and being able to relate with it and exist in it. And I think that's why kind of people are thrown off a lot by me when they meet me. They see photographs or whatever, and they go, "Wait a minute, this guy's a normal guy." Yeah, you can be a normal guy. In fact, I encourage people to be normal people, live in society, and enjoy life.
Yeah, I actually kind of dropped off the line there and just got back on, but I was able to hear what was going on. I wanted to pick up on the whole idea of occult science. I know this is something that you've talked about in other places, and that's something that I've also described magic as, is more occult science, being in that it's scientific knowledge, it's a scientific process that isn't either adopted by just the majority of people, it's not common understanding, or it's still hidden information that through meaning of a cult. When a scientist works on, let's say, studying viruses, they study the virus and everything, and they're going to leave a body of information behind. They're going to leave some practical knowledge that can be used by other people. They can pick it up and they can look at it. And I know you're talking about having bigger goals now, bigger agenda. What is it you're trying to leave behind with your work? Like when people look at your body of work after you're gone, after you've moved on, or however, whatever your belief system is, what is it you hope they take away from it? What is it you're hoping to leave behind?
Really, my main thing is that that each person has the absolute potential for omnipotence, omnipresence, and omniscience. That each person basically is God and can actively experience that. And so basically just the knowledge of that alone, that is the human potentiality, I think is intense. So if even a portion of the people who ever pick up any of my books get that, that's awesome. And then I'll go through and give actually the steps that I've taken that have worked for me to get me closer to that state.
Do you think that's a goal for the entire species? Should every human being try to manifest that omnipotence? Or do you think it's going to be limited to a stratification process where some people get it and are equipped to do so and some people do not?
No, I think that that one of the big the biggest blockage to everybody being able to do this is our culture. And not just the Western culture, but just about every human culture at this point. That if a lot of the cultural issues with all of this are removed, that it'll be accessible to everybody. I mean, I maintain if it weren't for Christianity, that the occult would be being taught in elementary school. I mean, once again, I've got journals filled with cause and effect, and several other people too. Like I said, I've got De Prince who lives off of what he manifests spiritually. You have miracle workers everywhere in India. Some of them are fake. Yeah, there are others that are definitely worth looking into.
Right on. Now, you talked about in something I read, you said that magic is basically simple, that we're not talking about anything really difficult, that anybody really can get this. I think you even kind of mentioned it during this interview here. Could you expand on that? Like, how is magic simple? Like, what do you mean?
Basically, if you can learn how to trigger your own physiological and psychological states, which would be... On the brainwave spectrum would basically be the theta brainwave state, which is optimally 4.5 hertz that you're generating with your brainwave activity. If you can hit that theta state and hold it for even momentarily without dropping into sleep, which you would do in meditation, ritual, prayer, etc., then you start triggering gamma waves in your brainwave activity, which is off the charts as far as what can be measured. Once you learn how to trigger those states, which is, once again, you can approach it through just about any paradigm, then you're really fully integrated into a field of consciousness and energy.
Right on. So, and you would suggest, what method works best for you, do you think? What's the method you recommend for getting into that theta wave state?
I think looking into a lot of the Hindu and yogic practices are extremely dependable and time-tested for getting into those states. As far as pranayama, control of breath, you really can't find a meditative discipline that doesn't include pranayama. And then for me, using bija mantras. These are single syllable mantras used by yogis that basically resonate with specific aspects of divinity within themselves and then external as well. Using those mantras in combination with pranayama, with control of breath, really just about instantly gets you into the theta, what I call the theta gamma sync.
Right on. Now, in another interview I've read, you talk about you were asked what you see happening in the future, like what direction do you see us going in, and you mentioned that you see a kind of revolution occurring. And on this particular show, revolution is something we talk about a lot. And I get this feeling not just from folks like yourself, but all over the Satanist forums and different magical and cult left hand path forums, that everybody's got a feeling that something big's coming down the line. And you talk about a revolution where things that are forbidden become the norm. Do you care to expand on that? Do you have what do you mean by that? What do you see that is currently forbidden actually becoming the norm in the future?
Well, we can look at that and just look at the last 50 years. And basically, there's not a lot that's still secret to anybody. I mean, you can go, you can jump on the internet and learn these things in the occult that would otherwise take you your whole life, and you'd have to learn 10 different languages and study with masters in order to get their trust, in order to even have these secrets. So, just what's opened up in the last 50 years is incredible. And it's growing exponentially, and you also see a massive shift in consciousness here as well. We've got the Middle East and Africa are all using a violent revolt against their tyrannical leaders. We see in the U.S., Canada, and parts of Europe that we've got these protests going on everywhere. It's like every part of the world. Everybody everywhere is going, no, this is not going to work anymore. This really patriarchal dominator society is just not going to be allowed to continue. So, where that goes to is going to be really interesting, and how it manifests is going to be really interesting. What's interesting to me is that it's really hard to use any kind of really esoteric prediction into how this all unfolds. I've tried to use divination methods, and other of my coworkers have as well, and people all over the world have tried to do remote viewing and astral projection, every kind of looking into the future, and they're not able to see very far. It's kind of a veil up that's I'm not sure really what's coming down the pike, but I do think it's something pretty big, and I don't necessarily think that it's end of the world scenario either. I do think that or anything even really necessarily destructive, but a mass awakening is definitely occurring.
I just got a couple of other kind of off to the side questions. And then there's some people in our chat room that have expressed they wanted to call in. So the phone number is 347-989-1371. If you're cool with that, you'd be cool with taking calls from our audience?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay. And these are just off-the-side kind of things. First of all, you were on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, I believe, on September 13th. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe that's right.
Okay. What was that like, man? I mean... George doesn't seem too keen on the whole left-hand path thing. I don't even know if that actually came up. What was being on Coast to Coast like?
It was a lot of fun. And George really was a fun guy to talk to, and the callers were great. It was all around a great experience. George did want to focus more on the spookier aspects of it all. I think he kind of likes to scare himself. So he wanted to get into the demons and curses and such like that. And that's fun. That's fun to talk about. That's definitely a part of what I've really immersed myself in. I would definitely like to get back on the phone with him at some point and discuss things like soul travel, like the actual, the practical applications of all of this on a more than just that spooky level of, you can do a ritual and have these weird things happen.
Right on. And then, of course, you're a published author. And during my research, I ran into a couple of, you know, different publishing houses that kind of associate themselves with you. Lee Law Publications, I might be mispronouncing that. And there was another one, Eternal Ascent Publications. And you're speaking to a couple of authors in waiting, basically. TC and I both, you know, either have worked on some books and things like that. What advice would you give to people who are interested in publishing books? How should they go about it?
Well, you know, what I did is actually just started writing. I had a manuscript for Kingdoms of Flame, my first book. Kind of had that I was working on, and some really great ideas of what I wanted, where I wanted to go with writing. And you know, I've been writing my entire life. I mean, ever since I can remember being able to write, I was writing stories and poems and articles, whatever I could. I started just submitting articles left and right for magazines. And a Finnish publisher, Exaxar, really just dug what I was about, what I was writing, and so I submitted my manuscript for Kingdoms of Flame, and they snatched it up, and I ended up doing four books with them. They kind of have a different business model than I do. They want to make an excellent collector's item book and sell it for a big price. I kind of feel like my message, especially as it progresses, is something I want to have in a lot of people's hands and not have to charge them outrageous amounts of money for them to get that information. So I went on and formed Eternal Ascent Publications. That was actually my attempt at self-publishing. I did two books through that, and really at the business end of the whole publishing career, it really kind of dragged on me. It kind of made it feel like I was clocking in and clocking out rather than just producing a piece of art and knowledge that I felt good about. I really got caught up in the numbers and the whole game of it. So I signed with Lila Publications to really do that aspect of it, so I could really focus on the book rather than worrying about the book sales and the marketing and all those other things that really detract from, I think, the more pure value of the thing.
And before we actually start taking callers, how can folks get in contact with you now, and how do they go about purchasing your books?
Well, you know, I'm on Facebook as EA Coetting. EA is just both capital, one word. There's no period separating, I don't think, and Coetting. And then, you know, I'm really active on Facebook as far as, you know, just communicating with people and keeping some good conversations going. And for buying my books, you can go to Lila Publications, and that's Lila, LEILAH.org. And they do have Evoking Eternity that's available now, and then tomorrow If Sissimus will be coming out.
Right on. All right, so, yeah, we're ready to take some callers, 347-999-1371. We had one of our frequent callers calling in and out, or saying he was going to call in, and he actually, I think, called in up once and then dropped the line. So we'll just wait to see what he does here.
Right, and in the meantime, I think I'm kind of curious as to Ipsissimus, what this book is going to be focused on.
Well, you look at the word Ipsissimus, you break down the etymology of it, and it's basically the greatest self or the highest self, what I would call the true self, and it is that state of personal omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence, and really how to, you know, my journey in getting, you know, nearing that point and working towards it, the various masters that I've worked with, the lessons that they've imparted on me and that I've been able to apply, and that's really all laid out there, and a good deal of it does focus on soul travel, you know, exiting your consciousness from your body and your brain, and then having experiences in that field of consciousness and energy.
Okay, that sounds interesting. My curiosity, obviously, well, probably not obvious to you, but as a little bit of a backdrop, my curiosity is just certain people in the left-hand path community, as of recently, have all been kind of clinging towards the title. So I found it rather interesting that that was the actual title of the next book that you were putting out. While we're waiting on the supposed callers or people that expressed that they had interest in calling, I thought maybe we might take a few minutes to kind of discuss if you're actually yourself making any kind of preparations for, any catastrophic, not even catastrophic necessarily, but a breakdown in the current economic system. And if so, what preparations are those?
No, I'm not at all. I'm not. I don't have a food storage going. I haven't actually. Just a couple years ago, I used to have basically an arsenal of firearms just for fun. I live in southern Utah, so you can go buy an assault rifle and walk out of it in about 30 minutes. So. I had a bit of an arsenal. I actually sold off all my guns. I just got to the point where, I've got one that I keep just for fun, but just where I don't really feel like that's a necessary thing. I don't see things going that path where it's going to be terrible. I mean, right now we're obviously in a recession and some might say a depression, but I'm not struggling. So. It's one of those things of, I'm not extremely concerned with that enough to start making massive preparations for some kind of cataclysm.
Right on. Well, we actually we have their caller on the line, so I thought I'd just bring them on. Zach, what's going on, man?
Hey guys, how you doing?
Hello.
Good. Yeah, so actually, I have a few questions, but I'll just limit it to two since I know we have people calling in and we're kind of pushing on time here. My first question is, first of all, you certainly have a deep and broad knowledge of the occult. What would you say to the cynics who would either say, either you're delusional or full of shit?
Well, that's fine. I'm not... I can definitely see, and I can see where people would say that. I think that that's a very fair criticism, and actually that's criticism I make of myself constantly. Of is this all delusional? Is this is this all something I'm concocting and creating these extraordinarily real phantoms that I'm interacting with? I think if you don't ask yourself that, then you'd probably have some serious instability going on because these are insane experiences that you have. But then again, I've got journals filled with cause and effect. It's really hard to look away from. That's kind of the thing that I kind of keep looking at is, well, yeah, the evidence for me is all stacked up as far as there's something real going on here. I think my understanding of what that is exactly that's going on is maturing and evolving with time. But the fact that I am tapping into something is kind of beyond question at this point for me.
Right on. Well, you seem really well put together. The fact that you would even ask yourself that question pretty much rules out the delusional thing, because most crazy people with delusional people don't really question their mental stability.
that is something you hear, you do come across those people a lot in the occult where they don't, that they're not asking themselves that, and I've seen a lot of people actually go into full delusion where they're not producing anything. That's one big reason that I really like to keep it practical, where I do have that journal entry where the cause and the effect is still in place, rather than just having these conversations with purple dragons in my imagination. I want to have something that I can see and touch and something that I can bring back to Earth with me.
Right on, right on. And my second question is, what are your thoughts on the afterlife?
Well, in the afterlife, basically that your consciousness, that you call your consciousness, will reintegrate itself into that field of consciousness, which I see basically as a fifth dimension, that you have the dimensions of height, depth, and width. You also have the dimension of time, and that you have a fifth dimension of consciousness, and that your consciousness will basically reintegrate with the group psyche, the group consciousness, which is transcends the human state by far. It's consciousness of everything. It's omniscience basically, and I like to think a lot about the whole reincarnation theory. I like to kind of ponder that. I'm really not convinced though, because everybody happens to be walking around as a reincarnation of Aleister Crowley or Cleopatra or whatever. It's really the whole reincarnation thing is really dubious when you start getting into, well, what were you in a past life? And then you can get into the fact that where all consciousness is linked together, it's just as easy for me to remember a past life that somebody else has as it would be for something that I did, since there's no real separation. So I do think there's a definite energetic and even consciousness recycling going on where everything keeps moving and keeps transcending. But and that consciousness can indeed survive physical death, I do think that it's a continual progress of the self and consciousness and the experience of consciousness.
Right on. Well, thanks for your time, man. That's all I got for you today.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
All right, we did have one person pop on for a minute, but they fell off when I put them in the screening room. So 111, if you're interested in actually asking our guests some questions, now's the time to call back in. In the meantime, Jason, I'm really trying to think of what the best direction to go next is. What do you think?
Well, I guess along the lines of what you were talking about with Zach, and something you mentioned about, in the future, reaching towards an awakening, a manifesting in all people of some connection with something, that is kind of stifled at the moment. Do you see that kind of manifestation, that awakening, that awareness? Will it also come with some sort of inherent responsibility? Will people recognize it and see it the same way, or could it lead to greater division? Like, I can imagine, just as you have people in the left-hand path who are going to have a very practical way of looking at this awakening, you're going to have people, let's say, who are, part of the Christian church and very deep into that, who are going to interpret it in an entirely different way, and that could lead to some serious issues. How do you see those kinds of that kind of manifestation or that kind of awakening?
It could lead to some really divisive curtains drawn across aspects of our society, but that really depends on how it presents itself. I mean, if we're looking at I actually do think that we're seeing more and more of that though. Just today, I mean, right now we're seeing that that a lot of these divisions are starting to die out. That you do have those fanatics on every side of the aisle, really, but that everybody can really sense that something is terribly wrong with the way things are and that it needs to change. And so I think as solutions come about for how those changes come and how we move into the next level of our progress as a species, that a lot of those boundaries will dissolve. And I think that's a good deal of what's going on is a dissolution of boundaries.
So it'll be kind of like the progression from the idea that the world was flat to the idea that the world was round, that you're still going to have holdouts that are going to cling to the idea that the world is flat, but the majority of people are going to move towards, this idea that
There is something more. There is a way to tap into it. There are these energies that are available, that kind of thing. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have a hard time finding anybody, even among atheists, who haven't had some kind of experience. They go, well, I can't explain that. I've had these things happen, and I just can't explain it. It gets written off. I think that's one fault of science. One big folly of science is that they write off what they would call the phenomenal or the side shots that fall off. If you're performing any kind of scientific test, you'll have 1,000 measurements that fit into the parameters, and 50 that don't. Those 50 get discarded. And I think that maybe it's those side shots, those aberrations that you need to look into. And I think I know that was looked into, because that's what really formed what we now know as quantum physics. When Einstein started talking about spooky action at a distance, that's what he was talking about. He goes, well, I can explain all these things, but I can't explain spooky action at a distance. And then that formed these panels of scientists getting together trying to explain these things. And now we're coming on quantum physics and string theory. So it, all of this is getting embraced. Physicists and science is just barely starting to catch up with what prophets and seers have been saying for millennia.
If you could tell someone what it was they should be doing right now, if it's for themselves, for the world, for whatever, if there was somebody who was, let's say, interested in pursuing magic and the occult in the same way you have, what would you tell them should be a goal that they should be shooting for? How would you tell them to get engaged?
Well, I think it would definitely come down to look at your life and what would be required in your life to make it paradisical? What would it take for you to feel complete peace, love, and power in your life, and bring those things to yourself? If you got that kind of goal in mind, where I want to enrich my life and be able to really fulfill a greater purpose beyond just struggling and kind of dragging your feet through every day, I think that you can apply just about any paradigm to that. You don't necessarily need to go to the occult. You do need to trigger those physiological states that the occult is great at triggering, but you can do the same thing with prayer, meditation, mantra, or ritual magic. But to actively engage your spirituality in manifesting paradise in your life.
Now, is there in this process, or do you think there's a set of governors? Paradise for you and paradise for me might be radically different. And paradise for some people could be horrendous for other people if they were to run into that kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about, for lack of a better term, deranged individuals, people who don't fit into society's parameters and are actually, their idea of paradise might actually bring harm to others. Do you think there are governors in place in these energies that you're dealing with that prevent that kind of thing, or do you think that's just going to be a consequence of this kind of manifestation, this awakening, that there's going to be some forms of paradise that just aren't cool with everybody else?
Well, right. I mean, there are, you might be putting too much information out right now with this, but I'm actively engaged with others in making changes in the world in the way things play out far beyond myself, because I do see that there are changes that need to be made in this world that things are getting derailed really fast in a direction that I don't care for. So as I'm trying to rearrange things, there are forces pushing against me, which are other people trying to manifest other realities. So you have that. You definitely have that. It's kind of a natural play of things. I mean, it's the whole you know, basically all of spirituality, religion, occultism, any spiritual practice is a tool. And just because you possess the tool doesn't mean that you're going to be able to exactly what you want without having to deal with other humans that are in the same field of consciousness, that are living on the same plane, doing the same things. So I think that it will have to come to a head at some point where there is a complete boundary dissolution, where basically things are moving towards kind of a unified action towards creating a mutual paradise, and that I think that the more aberrant of the folk who would want to create really hell as their paradise are going to find themselves kind of at the wayside, watching the majority of people who want paradise manifest.
So I found that kind of interesting, the idea that I'm assuming you're referring to different orders. There's different orders right now who are using basically the same processes but for radically different goals, kind of like in Crowley's Moonchild. There was a group who were charlatans or had some skill but were self-interested, I guess, in one way versus these other folks who were looking at, I don't know, in some way or some manner, the evolution of the species and the natural process. So what would you, I guess, from a philosophical standpoint, what are some of the things that you oppose in your work? What is it that you think should be actively avoided or actively fought against?
As far as kind of the system of things or as far as practices that you would put into place, I'm not sure.
Both, I guess. Yeah, what practices do you think you should oppose, and what systems do you think should be opposed?
You know, as far as practices, I would basically say anything is game. I mean, if you can get it to work with for yourself, and you can resonate with any specific practice, and you're able to produce results with it, go full steam with it. I do advocate pragmatism, of course, where you know you can actually put this into play. And make it, get it to make the changes in your physical reality, which, you know, I say that, and I say that really casually, and I think it might sound kind of odd for people, but, you know, that's what this is all about, is taking something that's really imaginative and ephemeral and getting that to make physical, substantial, verifiable changes in your world. And basically, if you can trigger that through any spiritual paradigm or any practice, go for it. And then what I think needs to be opposed really are in the system around us are boundaries. I mean, that's my main thing is boundary dissolution, where you know we're still in a society where you have to come out of the closet if you're gay. You don't have to come out of the closet if you're straight. It wasn't too long ago that there was a massive segregation racially in this country. So things are moving towards boundary dissolution quite a bit. And so I think that the more boundaries are up, and that's, you know, boundaries as far as, class, you know, financial boundaries and religious boundaries, political boundaries, those really need to all be taken off the table. And I do think it's amazing to consider if we're being observed by a species that's not native to this world, how silly we must look, fighting amongst ourselves when we really could be working towards something far greater, anything besides this squabbling that we're doing now. I mean, especially when you look at the U.S., where the political and economic system is horrible, and then you look over in Switzerland where they're artificially creating antimatter. There are boundaries there that really need to be broken down, and we can possibly start moving forward towards some actual human progress.
There are groups that are advocating in the left-hand path, and this has always been something that has been around, amorality, where there are no moral boundaries, there are no limitations. And that, of course, leads to things that society considers not welcome practice, but like as human sacrifice or animal sacrifice, that kind of thing. What would be your stance on that? First of all, on amorality, on a kind of anything goes, you know, there is no truth, all is permitted, that kind of thing. And then in magical practice, bloodletting, animal sacrifice, that kind of thing, you don't come across as the kind of guy, I guess, and I may be reading you wrong completely, that advocates such a thing. But is that, or where are you at on that, I guess, a hot button in the occult community?
Yeah, I am definitely a moral relativist. What is right and good for me may not be right and good for somebody else in another situation. It's not an amorality so much as it is a pragmatic morality. It's this is what works for me, and this is what makes me fulfilled. But I do recognize that there's a work towards self-actualization that is basically ingrained in everybody to have that fulfillment, to feel fulfilled in life, to be happy, to feel love and to feel peace. And I think that if you're amoral, where you're that term really would kind of lean more towards antisocial amorality, where you're doing things that are not the societal norm for shock value or for the sake of committing evil, you're really a ways away from self-actualization, but you'll get there. That's a process, and that's a process I went through. I mean, I've got a book I wrote, Baneful Magic, that details how to use spiritual manifestation to harm other people. I mean, I went through that dark night of the soul of I'm going to be as evil as I possibly can, and that's not a very high spiritual state, and that's not a state that I think people will maintain for any amount of time. It's a state that I think a lot of people pass through with that dark night of the soul, and how deep and how dark that is going to be dependent on that person and their own needs and circumstances. But I'm a moral relativist in that in my own life, what I do in my whole moral and ethical code needs to lead to me feeling peace, love, and power in my life, and if I don't feel that, especially the peace and the love, then something's awry. And if you're not working from a really healthy, stable place psychologically and emotionally, you're really going to be limited as far as not only your own understanding of yourself and the universe that you're integrated into, but that you'll also be hindered in your ability to manifest what you want to and manifest that paradise in your life, because you're not really coming at it with any clarity. And then for the second part of your question with blood sacrifice and such, being an initiate and actually a priest of Haitian Vodun, I've performed animal sacrifice. I don't have a massive issue with it if the animal is used, eaten. I don't have an issue with hunting, either. Go hunt and eat the animal. That's fine by me. Whether you're doing it in a slaughterhouse or in a ritual chamber, I don't think makes a huge difference. But if you're able to, if that's something that you're able to use in your own spiritual awakening, then you're basically not doing anything that's really extremely out of the ordinary. It's not the social norm to take a chicken in your backyard and kill it in a magic circle. But especially in rural areas, it is the norm to go in your backyard and kill a chicken. So if you're integrating it into your spirituality, Yeah, I really don't see a huge problem with that. Human sacrifice, you know, I can't say that that's a positive, progressive thing for people to do. That's definitely a pathology, and you know, I don't see that being a progressive spiritual thing at all.
Right on. And I mean, it's only to recently that it's been not commonplace, I guess, to kill our own animals and things like that. So definitely, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, actually, I was. I'm curious because he was talking about a higher spirituality, and he kind of inadvertently made a reference to being a lower form of spirituality. I was interested in hearing the distinction he makes between the two.
I'm sorry, between what two? You kind of blurred out for a second there.
Oh, sorry. High spirituality and lower spirituality.
Well, you know, and it's really a... I think it's a vision that that is made on an individual basis. As far as, you know, a lower spirituality would really, you know, wouldn't be. Once again, you'd have to kind of go back to Maslow's hierarchy and go, well, is the application of the spirituality and is the method of the spirituality lending towards my self-actualization, towards doing that which, you know, you're here to do. And that's for each person, obviously, to discover on their own what they're here to do. And really, if you look into Hinduism, you look into the whole idea of karma. Karma is not that you do something bad and something bad happens to you. It was never intended that way at all in the Vedas. It is that karma is the result of your attachment to things that your negative attachments obviously will draw more of that negativity towards yourself, but also that each person has a dharma, each person has a law that they follow, and it's their ethical code, and it's their purpose in life, and that once you've attained that knowledge of you know what you're supposed to do here, even if it's not necessarily what you're supposed to do until the day you die, but what you're supposed to do now, and you're following that. That's really where I would consider your higher spirituality, that you're pursuing something that transcends maybe your mundane desires or your selfish desires, and more the unfolding of the self.
So what do you think of spirituality that is focused specifically on obtaining these mundane desires as your you know, calling them. For instance, I myself, I tend to focus on becoming more human than what I am, instead of reaching out towards some imaginary God figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know, I really get into that a lot, where especially in Abscissimus, and then the book that's going to follow it up here in the spring is the book of Azazel. They both go together perfectly because they do both discuss that. The whole methods of soul travel and these mystical states are a way for you to kind of get in touch with and consciously recognize your spirituality, that you are a spiritual being having a physical experience. But then you get into what I call convergence, where the physical and the spiritual unite. And that's really why I harp on practical spirituality, which you are making changes in this world. And it'll start with mundane desires, with you know, wanting to attract wealth and love and whatever. But then I do think that you start looking outside of that and trying to create that peace, love, and power in your life. So, but it does need to be drawn back to this earth. One thing that you do run across a lot in the occult, and especially in Eastern philosophy and the right-hand path, kind of the more, you know, the lighter side of it, is that there's this tendency towards escapism, where, you know, rather than existing in the here and now, I'm going to go astral project and spend most of my time on these other planes, and you know, I can't wait till I die and return to my home in the 12th dimension. Well, that's not really what I think people ought to be focusing on. Rather than, you know, how do I get to heaven? I'm more concerned with how do I bring heaven here? How do I bring paradise here to Earth? Because this is where we're at, and I don't see this as being some sort of prison or test or anything like that. As far as this physical life, this is I think this is a good deal of what it's about for us, that we do have this amazing potential that we can utilize here and now, and that we really ought to be less concerned about, you know, escaping to some other dimension. We should get in touch with ourselves spiritually and really get a good look at our full spiritual potential, and then start using that, start applying it in our lives.
All right. I'm just like trying to wrap my head around this real quick. I guess what that I'm really curious about is, once again, you're reaching towards this outer idea of spiritual, and I'm thinking more in terms of becoming more human, embracing what is nature, the animal that really exists here in this world right now. And I'm just trying to find where the two kind of set in your mindset. I mean, is there a hard distinction? Are they not the same thing?
Well, you know, and that's I think it's a really we as a species are in a really really interesting situation where you know, in the words of Terence McKenna, you know, we've got the instincts and the reflexes of pack hunting wild apes. But then there's this consciousness that's in us that's leading towards that self-actualization, and so it can seem, you know, at first glance, that there's a definite battle between embracing the animalistic and embracing the spiritual, but the two do go hand in hand in a very, I think, streamlined way, especially when you embrace occultism, specifically the left-hand path, which does celebrate the fact that we are human, we have desires, and that we can use those states that you can reach in your spiritual evolution. So yeah, that you know, once again, if you are performing a ritual, there's an intense emotional element in it, and that's a big part of being human is emotion, and then you also look to, you know, into Haitian Bonhomme. One reason I'm drawn to that system is it celebrates what it is to be human, what it is to be the mammalian human, and that's excellent. But then we do also have that side of ourselves that is divine, and that's kind of, I guess, the balance that I'm talking about, is that we do have and need to maintain that balance between our divine spiritual self and our animal self, and because they do both exist, and I think both are pretty undeniable, but they basically do coexist as well.
Right on. Well, I'm not overly familiar with any of the Haitian system, so I'm kind of curious. Being that it's Devil's Night, and you know, it just wouldn't be right if we didn't do a little bit of talking about, you know, the entities that are described. Are there any particular favorites that you have?
Of entities, you know, I'm really gravitated a lot towards I guess what you call the Saturnian entities. The most would consider them to be demons. You know, where you have, you know, Azazel and kind of his whole host, where it's the spirits that teach forbidden knowledge. And he, you know, that's that in basically every paradigm that you come across, there is that. that kind of forbidden, darker spirit that that'll teach you everything you want to, you know, everything that you want to know. It'll answer all your questions, but it is kind of a darker path, and there is that that extreme unknown and forbidden about it. You know, you look at the Mayan religion, and it was Zabalba, that you basically had to walk the road of death in order to have these secrets revealed to you. And then Saturn is that same sphere, and Saturn, of course, is related to Hades. So you do have that theme, and that's really a big gravitation towards, for me, is that darker, forbidden aspect of spirituality, and that's why I would put myself more on the left-hand path than the right or the middle, because I do embrace the forbidden.
Awesome. All right. I'm trying to remember. I had a couple other questions, but they went. So, Jace, if you got anything, I'm trying to put my mind together here.
Okay.
Jason, yeah, he might be. Yeah.
I'm right here, dude. I had some trouble understanding. What did you say?
I was just saying that I was drawing a blank. If you had any other questions, now would be a good time.
Really, I'm just kind of curious about the Layla publications. How much are you associated with that?
That's basically the publisher that I'm going through now for the foreseeable future. Joshua Serafin is running Lila Publications, and he's extraordinarily dedicated to his artists and to the authenticity of the artist's vision. And so, you know, we work extremely close in making sure that the finished product matches up with the vision that I want to present to the world, it makes Lila an extremely rare publisher. Where, you know, rather than taking my manuscript and saying, well, what, you know, how do we make it our, you know, how do we put our brand name on it? It's mm-hmm. more, you know, how do we present this with the original intention of the artist?
Interesting.
Right on. And I also see that there's a link to something called the Ordo Antichristianus Illuminati. Are you a participant in that as well?
No, I'm not. That's I think that's something that Joshua helped formed with the help of the late Christopher Hyatt, I think, and that's kind of his own deal. That one really interesting thing about working with Joshua from Lila is that his spiritual beliefs and mine clash quite a bit, where he might consider himself more of a conservative Christian. And you know, he believes that the occult ought to be studied and studied intensely, but never engaged in. And I obviously think the exact opposite. Where you know, I really think everybody ought to be actively engaged in their spirituality at whatever level that they're capable. So, you know, we do have a lot of those personal disagreements, and so we'll, you know, we'll talk about that, and we'll even debate that, and we actually have a. We're scheduling a debate with he, myself, a few other authors from Lila, a few other occult authors that are more left-hand path, that we're going to be meeting up in Las Vegas and having an actual full debate and hash these ideas out. So it's interesting to work with him. You know, where we have that divide, but then we can still come together as far as, well, this knowledge is. This is pure knowledge. This is good information, and the vision is excellent. So let's get it out there. I mean, if you look on the Lila website, you'll see some of Josh's books, because he writes as well, and his are extremely geared at exposing conspiracies and exposing secret societies. And so it makes for a really interesting conversation to have with the person who's publishing books as really forbidden as mine seem to be.
You mentioned earlier that you're a single father. Do you mind if I ask how old your child is or children are?
Yeah, I have one daughter who's six.
Okay, yeah, I have a six-year-old as well. One of the things we frequently discuss here and in other forums and everything is parenting. Basically, you know, the issue of, you know, do we raise our child in our spirituality? Do we, you know, is it going to be, do we let them explore other spiritualities? You know, what do we do if they don't agree with our spirituality? How do we handle those kinds of things? So at 6 years old, they're asking all kinds of questions. They've been asking all kinds of questions for years. How are you handling that? Like, what plan do you have for your child as far as their spiritual rearing?
When my daughter was just, a baby and was just barely learning how to talk, she would be able to sense things that are out of place spiritually and energetically. And so when she would do that and vocalize it in whatever kind of primitive way she was able to, from 2 years old, I was teaching her, okay, well, here's how you get yourself surrounded by spiritual light and focused and grounded, and then to work with that spiritual world. So I've integrated that into her where it's not a big deal for her. It's nothing out of the ordinary to work with spirits, to work with consciousness and energy. I'm not sure that she'll continue that because I don't think it'll be interesting for her as she gets older. I mean, she's obviously, everybody wants to expand and develop. So, where she ends up as an adult, I think is going to blow my mind. Where, you know, it's taken me my life to get to where I'm at, and then I'm imparting that. Hopefully she's going to be able to just soar with it. I do definitely, keep options, other options open where, we'll go around and go to, various just churches in our area and experience it and experience other forms of spirituality. And I think there is also a compartmentalization that goes on with me for sure where I've got, I'll go into a ritual and I'll fully engage myself in that. But once again, I'm also a normal guy. I don't have, black drapes all over my house. It's a normal life, okay, now we're home, we're going to do homework and then make dinner and the normal stuff. But then there's the fact that there is that spiritual current running through everything.
Right on. Well, you've dealt with about an hour and a half of us drilling here at this point, and I'm just kind of curious, was there anything particular that you yourself wanted to talk about, or maybe you might have some questions for us?
I don't really have a specific agenda for a conversation, just a great conversation on practical spirituality. Yeah, I do. I've got this book, Obsessionless, coming out tomorrow. That's for me, it's the best book that I've ever written, and I say that with just about every book I write. So I'll look at it and go, wow, this is amazing. It's something I really, really believe in heartily as far as giving people not only the knowledge that. And the understanding of okay, there's a manifold essence to who you are. It's not just the body. It's not just the animal. But there's something else. There's this consciousness that you can explore very actively, and then giving those tools. And that's what Obsessionless really is about. It's attaining that higher self, realizing that there is that higher self, that there is that. That spiritual and divine component to who we are, and then here's the tools to be able to access that directly, and to have to bring that into a full conscious experience.
Right on. You were talking earlier about the theta frequency. Is that what you dubbed it?
Yeah. I've kind of coined a term, the theta gamma sync. As I was kind of researching for my book Questing After Visions, I was researching a lot into what is this visionary state? You know, what is it, and what's triggering it? And it all kind of kept leading back to getting into this theta gamma sync, where your brainwave activity is usually either alpha or beta, which is either your I believe it's in alpha, that you're just relaxed, you're going about your day, you're not really focused on anything intently, but you're conscious and you're actively conscious. And then beta, which is you're extremely focused. If you're studying, if you're reading, if you're doing anything that's engaging you more on an intellectual level, you'll be in the beta range. And then you have delta, which is sleep. Well, people will pass through pass from beta and alpha and just hold theta for just a split second before they fall asleep. And that theta state is, if you're falling asleep, it's the state where you experience hypnagogia, where you know you'll before you hit sleep paralysis, where you know you might have a little vision that you're, you know, roller skating down the street, you fall and you jerk. It says that state where the hypnagogic hallucinations kick in, and that can be accessed through meditation. This is spoken about in occult terms as the Gnostic trance. That's often what it's called, is the Gnostic trance. In Eastern philosophy, it would be, you know, the transcendental mind state. In technical, scientific terms, it's the theta brainwave state, and that holding that theta brainwave state in a while remaining conscious without passing into delta sleep, that's when you're actually able to trigger these supernatural phenomena, where your consciousness is no longer acting completely local to the brain and the body, but that it's seeming to merge with that field or that dimension of consciousness.
It's interesting. It kind of reminds me of the Pythagorean's harmony of spheres, if you're familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite a bit. And you know, Pythagoras was you know, one of the first great philosophers. And so you can kind of look back and go, this is not something new. This is, you know, once again, I'm using terms and using vocabulary that I've kind of plucked out of quantum physics and psychology and neurophysiology, but it's the exact same thing that's been spoken of by prophets and seers for millennia, and sorcerers and witches, all these really societal fringe dwellers have been saying this stuff that now kind of the scientific community is starting to catch on to.
Right on. You know, it's this particular aspect of the discussion is quite fascinating to me. I myself have been working for a while on inducing different mind states using frequency as an activation point. You know, where it might take the average practitioner, I don't know, you know, a couple of hours to shift from one point in a ritual to another point in the ritual in the mind state that they need. I've been trying to kind of jumpstart it by using different frequencies. It's just kind of been an idea for me. It developed when I first started looking into hypnosis and then neurolinguistics programming, and the idea of actually taking magic squares and different symbols and different mantras, whatever, and transferring them into a frequency arrangement that produces all of these things in an auditorial sense rather than you know, visual, audio, and everything else, but just strictly on that level. So I think it's kind of cool that you're looking into that as well.
Well, what was really cool is as I was researching these brainwave states, that they do have that auditory and musical quality to them and to the triggers to them. Where if you look at As far as you know, tribal music, they started looking into the music that shaman would be playing, usually with drums or some other percussion instrument. That at the moment of that theta switch, that they're playing at about 4.5 beats per second. Now, you know, if you remember back when I said the theta state, the optimal output would be 4.5 hertz. So that's a really interesting kind of correlation there, but that you can just take it, and you can do it with the frequency. You can also do it with the beats. And I've got a friend who does who does musical arrangements and concerts and whatnot. And we've kind of played with that a little bit as far as using different beat patterns in the music to affect the entire audience. To get them into different brainwave states, and it's a really interesting thing to go from alpha into high beta and then down into theta, and you can see that reaction in the audience just in the different brainwave states that they cycle through. So yeah, it's something that's, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, you're sitting down doing these incantations and these spooky things and Eye of Newt and it all works out. No, this is something that you can actually start doing with scientific method and with actual physical instruments to trigger these physiological and psychological states.
So 4.5 hertz, that's, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that's almost a really, really low A sharp.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. I'm not extraordinarily musical, though.
Right.
So,
well,
yeah.
I personally, I've only recently come to correlate what the different levels of hertz and megahertz are with the notes because of this particular interest of mine. So your guess is probably as good as mine.
Yeah. I don't know if you've, you know, while we're on that subject, I don't know if you've looked into this at all, but the recordings of the sun, the actual music that you can hear in the vibrations that are being put off by the solar light, and then the different vibrations coming from the various planets in our solar system that people are recording, filtering out the background noise, and you actually hear what really appears to be music coming from everywhere around. Producing a certain frequency that's going to cause certain physiological and psychological alterations. You can do that through software and hardware, but that's also being done constantly through our environment. And even outside of this Earth, where even the solar rays possess to them a certain musical frequency.
Right. I think I remember reading something about that a little while back. It was in an article addressing the mantra. I can't remember what it's called, but it's just the singular sound and that having something specifically to do with the sun. But again, I'm not really certain as to what I was reading about it.
Well, and really, you know, it is kind of funny to watch as these things get to be brought out scientifically, especially when you look into quantum physics. Just about every paradigm can piggyback themselves along that and go, you know, I mean, I've known Mormons who, you know, I live in Utah, so that's kind of my surrounding. And Mormons are looking at string theory and going, see, this perfectly proves what Joseph Smith said about Mormonism. And then Buddhists are saying, no, this proves what we've been saying. And that's, I think, part of the boundary dissolution that I'm talking about where all these different rivers are starting to converge, and people are going, wait a minute, we're all talking about the same thing. We're just using different vocabulary.
Right. It's like we have a little blog here. It's eminentmind.info. It's kind of the philosophical aspect of any kind of necessary paradigm. It's just discussing different ideas, different concepts. One thing in particular we're extremely interested in, or at least I myself am, is the corrosive aspects and the aspects. I mean, what the Hindus might refer to as the Kali Yoga or Kali Veda, if I'm trying to remember.
Well, you know, you've got the that could really be in reference to a few things where you have what the Vedas have called the Kali Yuga, which
Yuga, that's it.
Yeah, which is the dark age in which we're living, and that's kind of based on a model of the degradation of man's spirituality, and I don't necessarily agree with that fully. The only way that I can really agree with the whole concept of the Kali Yuga, because what's based on is basically that at one point in human civilization that there was this golden age, and it was where everything was perfect. It's what Christians would call Eden, and that we somehow fell or came out of that golden age and have declined ever since. And the only way I could really jump on board that is if this is a cycle. You know, you look at the Mayan calendar, and everyone's afraid that it's that the time is going to end here in about a year. I look at that calendar, and to me, it looks like a circle. So you know, if we're coming out of the Kali Yuga and moving back into a golden age, I could see that. Otherwise, I would have to say that the opposite is occurring, which is that more along the lines of an evolution, where you know there was the obvious genetic and physical evolution of our species from basically single-celled organism into what we are now, where the human neocortex is the most, you know, informationally dense object that we know about in the universe, which is a pretty intense thing on its own, and that there's this progress, that we're actually progressing towards that golden age, not away from it. That's more how it seems to me. Now, it's tumultuous for sure. It's hard to look at the world and go, well, yeah, this is you know, getting better every day. But really, really it is. If you look at where technology has gone just the last 100 years, medical science, astrophysics, quantum physics, where everything is heading, if we look through our history, we're not able to put our finger on the timeline anywhere else but here and say this is as good as it's been.
Right. What do you think? I mean, Julius Evola, he actually kind of proposed that we were entering into the fifth Veda. I'm thinking that his mindset was that there'd be a new age where something that hasn't existed before has risen up. So it wouldn't be another golden age, but rather another link in the chain, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, that's also reflected a lot in Hermetics and in the teachings of Crowley, where, you know, the passing of various aeons and a quickening of that. And, you know, I could jump aboard that a lot more than the thought of a Kali Yuga, where this is a completely dark age, but that we are moving into another stage of our evolution, and you'll notice that these evolutionary leaps are occurring faster and faster. The Industrial Revolution was really just around the corner, and look at where we're at now. So we're moving exponentially faster towards some sort of critical mass, it seems like, where things are going to break through into a closer semblance of what I believe is our potentiality, which you know, once again, far surpasses just the struggle to get through every day.
Right on. Well, we're We're pushing about 9.5 minutes out of the end of the show. Jason, do you have any final questions you want to ask him?
I think it's just reading about what you're doing and everything else. I enjoy, you know, running into somebody who actually has a practical application for these kinds of things and sees things in a practical sort of manner, even though we're dealing with what other people would term the fantastic. So the more and more I read about you, I'm looking forward to reading your books, just the more interested I become. So very cool. I'm just glad we had an opportunity to chat for a couple hours.
Excellent. Thank you. No, it's great. And yeah, that is the big thing that I push is, you know, have these experiences. And don't take my word for it, you know, by any means. You know, have these experiences, get into the visionary state, get into all this and find it out for yourself. You might arrive at different conclusions than I have, and that's cool. But be actively engaged in really understanding your true nature and the nature of the world around you, because I don't think that it is what it appears to be at the surface. I think that the closer you look at it, you know, the closer you look, kind of the bigger the whole thing gets, and really just dive into it, you know, with whatever paradigm you happen to be at, you know, whatever your spiritual path is, really engage in it to the point of pushing beyond what you perceive to be your boundaries.
Awesome. I personally, I want to thank you myself. I mean, it's been definitely an interesting experience. I'm glad we had the opportunity to arrange this, and I hope that it was everything you expected it to be.
Yeah, no, great conversation. I appreciate it, and you know, I'd always love to come back on if you guys would like, and talk some more at any point for sure. This has been great.
Right on. I definitely see that as a big possibility in the future. I'll give our audience a chance to kind of, you know, hit me back with some responses to tonight's show, and that way I can assemble, I don't know, maybe a different direction to go. It seemed tonight we were every which way trying to cover every little bit. The recording period was kind of messy. So.
Yes, and there are... Obviously, you're going to have people that are more interested in different aspects of things and possibly things that we haven't covered. So yeah, by all means, you know, if there are questions, which I'm sure, I mean, like you said, we've just kind of skimmed over a whole lot. I mean, there's a whole lot of information that we kind of threw out there real fast. So yeah, by all means, I'd love to come back on and kind of maybe narrow down into some other more specific avenues as well, for sure.
Right on. Well, I guess we'll go ahead and let you go, and we'll finish out the last few minutes of the show doing our usual thing. Thank you again for coming on.
Thank you.
And thanks, man. Good conversation.
Thank you. You guys have a good night.
You too, sir.
Oh.
All right. Okay. Wow. Wow. Talk about taking your brain for a walk tonight.
Yeah, that was definitely cool. Definitely worth the time. Just a lot of things to think about, a lot of things to consider. And like I said, the more I dig, the more I look into, you know, what's going on. And I ran into some stuff that I other questions. I'll just have to take it to him from some other way, because I didn't want him to feel trapped by some of the questions I would have started asking. Really seems like a really interesting dude. So it'll be interesting. I want to see what his. I actually want to read his book, see what that's about. I've read different interviews and different critiques. Most of it's been positive. But just be, you know. Hopefully, you know, I'm expecting based on that conversation that it will be different from what I've read other places. Although, you know, some of what he was saying was along those same lines. It sounds like he does take it to another level, or takes it to the next step. So it'll be interesting.
Right. I think I myself am going to grab up a couple of the guys' books and take a look at them. Just having had a couple of discussions with him now, one on the phone and one here on the Ooze, it definitely piqued some interest of things that I'd like to discuss with him. It's apparent in some aspects that the two of us definitely don't see eye to eye on things, where he's kind of leaning towards the left-hand path. I'm convinced after tonight that I'm just absolutely at the edge of the razor's edge of the spectrum.
Right. Well, I think there's a lot of there was a lot of effort to be positive, I guess is the only way I could put it. While he recognizes that we're in a tumultuous time right now. He's looking at a more positive outcome or a more positive expression of what's going on, which I don't know if I necessarily agree with it. I don't necessarily agree with a lot of the other things or some of the other things he was saying as well. But again, he's making it work. I mean, that's the one thing I got to give the guy props for. If everything he's saying is true about himself, and I can't think of any reason why he would, because he's not holding himself up as being a leader of anything. He's not holding himself up as being ultra successful, in the regular sort of life. He's just holding himself up as being a regular dude who doesn't have a lot of the same concerns the rest of us have. So I'm curious as to, what is it he's doing that he's got going on? If it is successful, well, then, of course, that's, you want to emulate what you see as successful.
Right on. And so we got about 2.5 minutes left. What's going on Tuesday night?
Tuesday night, that's a good question. I know that on the 11th or the Tuesday before the 11th, before Veterans Day, I don't think it's this Tuesday, but we're actually going to be talking about the military. Rotten Biohazard and I are going to have a conversation, and we've had a conversation before about the military, kind of got into it. He was asking me about it, as a former soldier, what do I think of, the military, and that's on the 8th. So, okay, on the 1st, we're going to be talking about population control, and mainly what we're talking about there is, the different methods, sterilization, abortion, limited propagation, that are starting to sponsor certain social issues. Basically, it's not just a matter of, the amount of resources that we have becoming limited. That's not necessarily the case. I'm of the opinion that the world has all the resources one could possibly want, that our population is, there's more than enough to sustain the population. The issue is how we interact with one another, how we deal with each other, and what certain population controls, if put in place, how that would affect and change the way that we deal with one another, with social issues that might be resolved. Social issues that might be created. I posted in the description on the Ooze WordPress page, oozeradio.wordpress.com. Mothers of the world, prepare to be offended. So I'm expecting it to be an interesting show on the 1st.
Right on. All right. With all that being said and done, everybody catch us on Tuesday night, and I'm going to roll the outro and get us out of here, man.
Right on.